Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way. From design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/Green Festival.
This is Coast to Coast. I'm Carol Masser. We are here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance and the most interesting stories in global technology from Silicon Valley and beyond, powered by our more than 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries. You can download Coast to Coast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com. You can also listen to our radio show weekdays at 2 p.m. Eastern only on Bloomberg Radio. Certainly one of the big stories of the day, if not the big story, is Turkey edging closer to a full-blown financial meltdown. We did have a headline just cross. Turkey saying it will retaliate to the U.S. raising tariffs. This is coming from the Anadolu agency, so we're tracking that. Let's get into Turkey because we've had a lot going on in that nation. Peter Cheer is head of macro strategy at Academy Securities, based in Connecticut, in our Bloomberg 1130 studio right here in New York City. Also with us, retired Brigadier General Anthony Tata. He's advisory board member also at Academy, and he's on the phone from Alexandria, Virginia. Peter, I want to start with you. You don't own Turkish debt, but you have looked at emerging market debt in the past, have owned it. When you look at this situation, how do you see it?
We have stayed outside of Turkey for quite a while. We had a very strong view on the geopolitical side that they were moving away from the West, moving away from NATO. So this is kind of taken on an extreme thing, but you're seeing that FX move. And what really concerns us is they have about $60 billion worth of foreign debt. So, you know, international debt, that's problematic, right? That is a very large amount of debt. It's starting now to impact other EM countries. So you're seeing EM as a whole sell off on the back of this. There will be a buying opportunity. We think not yet, and definitely not Turkey.
And so, General Tate, I want to bring you in here because, you know, one of the issues with Turkey seems to be that it wasn't that long ago that we were looking at a situation where Turkey was sort of coming along and seeming sort of progressive. Geopolitically, what's changed here?
Yeah, you're exactly right. They were moving toward partnership with the EU. They've been a longstanding in the waiting line to be a full partner with the EU. And recently, after the coup attempt, I think Erdogan didn't know who to trust. Plus, if you recall, during the Second Gulf War, they denied our passage through Turkey to attack into Iraq from the north. And so there's always been some kind of tension with Turkey. It's a NATO member. But at the same time, it's someone who's got the Kurds in the West. They've got the ISIS fighting along their border with Syria, and it's three-dimensional chess in Turkey, so to speak. And now what we're seeing is a drifting away, as Peter said, from the West and toward Russia, quite frankly. And I think what President Trump is doing here is watching Turkey move toward Russia by buying missiles from them, which is in violation of the sanctions. And plus, they're holding captive an American pastor there. And there are some other issues. And so I think the president is leveraging his economic power.
Yeah, and I think this ties in another reason markets a little bit more spooked. As they move towards Russia, that's going to complicate our relationship with Russia, which is already a difficult relationship.
Well, who helps them or who bails them out maybe ultimately? Or is that what you see – or is that where you see us going with Turkey?
I think, you know, the risk is that they kind of, you know, get more and more embedded into Russia because mm-hmm. we have missed opportunity after opportunity. You know, I really thought, say, Venezuela, which was having a lot of trouble, we would be the one to go in, fix up their oil fields. As the generals like to say, you know, business tends to follow the flag. And yet it was India that went there and is fixing it up, right? So I think we've lost our way on that. We have too many things going on. So I think we run the real risk of pushing, you know, Turkey further away to the east and, you know, into Russia, into China, and that hurts us.
Has the U.S. lost its way, or has the U.S. made a choice? And I ask that because you had President Trump tweeting today, here, you know, Turkey's coming undone, the lira is, you know, tumbling, and then you have President Trump kind of doubling down when it comes to tariffs, Peter.
Yeah, I think a lot of this would fit into what the general has been seeing kind of geopolitically, but we have been stepping back from regions.
And General, I want to bring you in here because to that exact point, because it wasn't so long ago, in fact, it could be measured in weeks, that President Trump was at a summit with Vladimir Putin, and notably at a recent meeting, you know, was kind of hanging out, to use a technical term, with President Erdogan. So, I mean, this is a very complicated relationship, to say the least. Where does it go from here, in your estimation?
Well, you know, I think the president is a pretty savvy negotiator, and what he puts a lot of trust, faith, and confidence in personal relationships. Mm. At the same time, this administration is one of the best I've ever seen at leveraging the elements of national power, which are diplomatic, information, military, and economic. And you can pull each of those levers one at a time or all at a time to get whatever strategic effect you want. And what he's doing here is he's pulling that economic lever for different reasons, because diplomatically they're not backing away from Russia. They're not handing over the captive and so forth. And so he's saying, all right, you want to play that game. You know, I can have a personal relationship with you, but I'm still going to act in America first geopolitical interest.
So, General Tate, you don't see the president moves today as reckless. You see them as strategic.
Oh, absolutely. Strategic. I think the president and his national security team are very strategic. They're taking, every region. You look at the number of fires he got handed, and it's not by coincidence that he's taken this strong action against Turkey. Once we've kind of got ISIS in the bag, you know, we kind of needed Turkey from an intelligence standpoint and a military base standpoint to continue the fight against ISIS. We've kind of got that in the bag there in Syria. And now he's taken this strong step where if Turkey reprises against us, it's not as impactful in the ISIS fight.
So, Peter, what do we do from an investor's perspective? How do we read this in the financial markets?
I think first you stay away from Turkey as an investment. I think there's too much, you know, risk that this continues to devolve.
Does it spread, though?
Contained or contagious?
I think
Peter.
It's contained. So I think you're going to want to start adding some EM in the meantime. I think you want to take some money out of high yield and actually put it into EM, because if it continues to get worse, high yield's kind of the next to go in line. One thing that I found really interesting is that Bitcoin is actually selling off during this whole, you know, week. And to me, you would have thought in a sort of, you know, emerging markets crisis, Bitcoin, certainly whenever North Korea kind of had something going on, that rallied. So I don't know whether that's completely lost its way. Not that it's a true investment necessarily, but that's kind of caught my eye. Away from this, I think the Treasury rally is probably a little bit overdone, so I'd kind of take advantage of that, take some profits there. I don't think this is going to hit the U.S. economy at all. I think the U.S. stock market reaction is about right now, down 1%-ish. That feels about right given the size of this.
Right.
It's going to be amazing to watch. General Tate, I'm expecting that maybe this could be the basis for your new novel.
Well,
you're a best-selling author, after all.
So our Dark Winter comes out in October.
There you go. See, I love authors. They always find a way to plug. So General Anthony Tata joining us, as well as Peter Cheer here in our Bloomberg 1130 studios, both of Academy Securities. Thank you so much. That's one way to get into this story, Carol Masser. This, as you said, is one of the most read stories on the Bloomberg. And I'm just going to read the headline. More women making it on Wall Street aren't on the street at all. Talk about a curveball. Let's get more on the story from the author. It is Liz Capo McCormick. She's one of our rock star reporters and writers here at Bloomberg, joining us on the phone from here in New York City. Liz, great to talk to you. Great story. So give us the dirt here. What's going on?
Thanks so much. So, you know, it's funny, like, Carol was kindly had me on when I had another feature on women in asset management. And after I did that, Jason, I was saying, wow, a lot of these women who are key fund managers, they're not where you think. They're in this kind of cluster in the West Coast and, you know, kind of Northern California. So it kept hankering at me. And then I talked to Laura Luton at Morningstar, who kind of ran some numbers. And it's amazing. Like, you know, you saw we have a table in the story that shows, like, they ranked, you know, what of the firms, the share of name women fund managers out of all the fund managers. And, the top firms, Charles Schwab's and Dodds and Cox, were in San Francisco, and there's another nearby. And it's just interesting. So I got John, my co-writer, John Gittleson, out on the West Coast, and we were digging and kind of trying to say, why is this? And, we detail in the story that a lot of people say maybe for women kind of sadly, right? I mean, it should be easier, but trying to crack in to Wall Street on the asset management side, it's kind of harder where the older networks are, let's call it old boy networks, even Boston, New York, and not that you have to avoid them by any means, but it's just like new areas, and maybe the West Coast is a bit entrepreneurial, so it just was very interesting. It's not kind of what you think for Northern California.
Well, you talked to some specific women. Liz, talk to us a little bit about their journeys and what they had to say about it.
Well, yeah, that was definitely interesting. From all levels, like I spoke to Barb McKenzie, who's at Principal Global, who their firm was just kind of named as a top firm for women recruiting, in general to work, which is nice. But they're out in Iowa, and I was talking to her. Besides her background of kind of growing up there, why did she stay there, and why they, have a lot of women named fund managers? And she was saying, their firm has done a lot to, move women up the curve where they need some, extra help from executives and putting them in that program. And she said a little bit, maybe you can't just tap so many people as you would when, on the East Coast. So they're nurturing talent. And so she mentioned some things even they're doing with the University of Iowa. Now, Christy Mitchum, who is great, who's, top at Wells Fargo Asset Management, she said, hey, Liz, and she's done a lot for promoting women in the industry, said she personally found she was going back and forth to the, she went to the West Coast for personal reasons, but back east because she felt she needed to be relevant. And we lay out in the story some firms who really did some things and saw her, how important she was and made it work for her with family needs.
Can I just point out, because this stood out for me, you talk about her former employer, Goldman Sachs, who actually provided a New York apartment for her and her daughter, as well as a nanny, so she could go, work there full time, and flew them back home each weekend. So they really went to great steps to make it doable for her.
Right. I mean, Christy said her own words to me were, Goldman made it happen. And, she was saying there are many firms. She worked for State Street, and they're great with her. And, that it is a lot, too, with the culture of the firm, and are they willing to, accommodate different needs, And, she said they made it happen.
Well, and it is interesting. I know Christy pretty well. She and I have worked on a number of things together, and she was influential, actually, in a project we did over at Bloomberg Television back on International Women's Day, where we essentially had all of our experts for that day as women. She is incredibly plugged in. And as you say, I mean, what I think is so interesting about this story too, and her specific story, is that firms will pay up for top performers. They will go out of their way. And so as people like Christy and others emerge, firms are taking notice. It is interesting, though, sitting here in New York, that so much of this is happening off of
elsewhere.
Wall Street.
Elsewhere.
Right. And it's interesting, as well as John went up to Schwab in San Francisco and met with Maria Chandoa, who is, wonderful and very much like Christy, doing a lot to help women in the industry. But we spoke to one of her younger colleagues who's, just coming up, this woman at the end of the story, Jane, who was saying how it does help, and you see this in a lot of firms, even Dana Emery is the CEO of Dodge & Cox, that these women coming up saying it's really great, kind of what you're saying, Jason, to see women succeeding, like women, like you become what you see, right? You
say,
oh, wow, I see these companies where we have these women at the top echelons, and it's motivating, It's, I think, it's empowering to younger women.
Well, it also shows it's possible, right? Like,
right.
If she can do it and she got there, then I can get there. There's nothing like seeing a great example. Liz, I love your reporting, so thank thank you, thank you for coming on and chatting with us. Liz Capo McCormick, bond and FX reporter at Bloomberg News, on the phone in New York. Like, who knew, right, Jason?
I know. Well, Liz knew. I mean, she's a rock star. Her stuff is always must read. So it's great to see this play as well as it is on the terminal. And interesting to see how well read it was. I think that's notable as well.
I love it, especially on a busy news day.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
I've been shopping with a list from A to Z.
All right, everybody. Yep, we know. We do a lot of shopping on Amazon. And let me just throw out a number, and it does relate to Amazon. 5%, but the question is it a little or a lot? And that is exactly the question our Bloomberg Opinion technology columnist Shira Ovadeh asked this week when writing about Amazon. She joins us in our Bloomberg 11:30 studio. We love this story.
This is my favorite story. This was officially my favorite story in Business Week this
week. If you're going on a summer picnic.
I said it on the record.
You did.
No Steve Mnuchin cover story?
I love the cover story too, but this was a very provocative question, Shira. So what made you go dig into this?
You know, I started doing some math in part because our colleagues at Bloomberg Intelligence did an analysis a while ago looking at the total volume of stuff sold on Amazon, which is a number that Amazon itself does not disclose, that they disclose the revenue that Amazon generates. But, for example, if Nike sells a pair of shoes on Amazon and Amazon takes a commission, Amazon discloses the commission that it makes on that sale, but not the full value of that purchase. So based on some estimates that our Bloomberg Intelligence folks did, you know, I kind of dug into how much stuff is actually sold on Amazon. And it turns out in the U.S., roughly last year, there was about $200 billion worth of Nike shoes and everything else under the sun sold on Amazon.com or at its Whole Foods grocery chains. And then I was kind of stuck with, is that a lot? Or isn't it? I mean, it is roughly 5% of all of the goods that Americans buy every year, if you look at government data.
Across the board, not just
across
online,
because
that's a different number.
Correct, that is a different
and
number.
And what is that number? Because that one is surprising as well.
That number is going to be something like 50%
wow.
this year. That's based on the research firm.
Amazon selling roughly 50% of everything sold online.
In the United States, correct. Yeah, so you know, there's obviously this disconnect, right, between that 5% number and the 50% number. And part of that is it goes to show that in America, we're still doing roughly 90% of every purchase in a physical store.
Right.
Right. So Amazon is only able to capture that 10% or so that people are buying online, although obviously that number is going up. And as that percentage of online sales goes up, then Amazon disproportionately benefits if it's getting 50 cents on every dollar.
Sarah, is it a little or is it a lot? Because I'm thinking about it. If I own the stock,
yeah.
and we talk about the valuation, it's crazy. Like current PE is, I think, about 100, 109. Forward-looking PE is almost 200.
Yeah,
you might say, well, if it's only got 5% of the retail market, look, it can go after the 95% it doesn't have. And so I'm going to pay up and buy this stock. So that's kind of one argument, right?
I mean, and that is the bullish case on Amazon is that, look, this is a company that is right now valued at more than $900 billion on the stock market.
Right.
And part of that is based on the enthusiasm that, hey, if they have so much revenue and so much market value now capturing 5% of U.S. retail sales and maybe 1% of the globe's retail sales, imagine what this company could be worth if that market penetration starts to go up.
Well, it's also very much in Amazon's best interest, at least when they're talking to regulators, to say, it's just a little. Oh, nothing to see here.
Just a little minnow.
Yes, it is. It has been very interesting to see that Amazon itself, when it does talk about its market power, it stresses that 5% number. They've given slightly smaller numbers, more like 4%. But the point is, it is in their interest to have that number be small when they're talking to politicians and regulators, because they can say, look, we're a minnow in this vast sea. We're not overly powerful. We just have this tiny market share.
Are they right? Because you also include in your story, you say, okay, so according to Bloomberg Intelligence, you're talking about $200 billion worth of stuff that Amazon sells in the U.S. Walmart sells how much in the U.S.?
I've now forgotten the number, but
381 billion.
Thank you very much.
So almost,
yes, it's 10%,
double.
Right? It's double the market share. And as far as I know, at least right now, in the 90s, it was a different story. But right now, nobody's talking about Amazon being too powerful the way that the president, for example, has kind of worried about Amazon being too powerful sometimes. And folks on the left as well, people like Elizabeth Warren, have also talked about Amazon being too powerful. So yes, that market share number does help them. But again, going back to the Jason's number about the 50%, that's the other way of looking at the market, right, is that they have an enormous power over this fast-growing part of the U.S. economy, which is online shopping.
And just to underscore that, Amazon is growing from a top-line perspective at 25 to 30% a year. And so you start to think about how that grows, and it's not going to be 4 or 5% for long because obviously their growth – just doing a little bit of math here, is outpacing the growth of the overall market.
Yes, it's something like four times the rate of total U.S. retail spending.
So what should we do about this? Like if you're a lawmaker, if you're a competitor, what do you do with this number?
I don't know. I don't know what you do about Amazon on anybody's part. I mean, from the competitor point of view, it has been interesting to see Walmart in particular – starting to kind of attack Walmart where they live, which is online, right? That Amazon bought Jet.com, which was this company born in e-commerce, run by a former Amazon executive. And they have been much more aggressive in e-commerce recently in the last couple of years. So there is definitely more competition for Amazon online than there has been maybe for years.
I have a quick question. 30 seconds left here. Will it be ultimately what happens to consumers? Are consumers benefiting by having Amazon in the marketplace?
I mean, look, certainly Amazon has been a boon for a lot of shoppers. I'm a Prime member and I enjoy it.
But I mean, pricing or do
but
we...
The secret of Amazon is that their pricing is not cheap.
Yeah.
It's not the cheapest. And
it
I don't know to what extent people realize that or if the convenience of Prime and free shipping outweighs the prices.
I love this story. I continue. I only love this story more, having heard more from Jira about this. I'm not kidding.
It is a great story. It's a great read, and check it out in Bloomberg Business Week this weekend. Catch Jason and myself on Bloomberg Business Week on radio and TV throughout the weekend. Do not miss it. Shira Ovideh, you are the best technology columnist at Bloomberg Opinion in our New York studio.
Every day I write the book.
Well, I don't know if every day he writes a book, but he certainly does have a new book out. Angel investor Elad Gil has worked with the likes of Airbnb, Twitter, Google, so many others as they went from growth startups to well-known brands. He does have a new book out. It's called The High Growth Handbook, and he joins us to tell us a little bit about it from Silicon Valley. He's co-founder and chairman of Color Genomics. And listen, Elad, great to have you here. Jason and I want to get into your book, but we got to mention a headline that crossed the Bloomberg having to do with another high growth or hoping to be high growth startup, and that is Tesla. The CEO, Elon Musk, and advisors seeking a wide pool of investors to back a potential take private of the automaker, really to avoid concentrating ownership among a few large holders. And this is according to people familiar. It's a story that we've all been focused on, rightfully so, this week. Elad, you've worked with a lot of growth startups. When you see the Tesla story and the thoughts of taking it maybe private, I'm curious what comes to mind. How would you be advising Elon Musk right now?
You know, it's a really interesting question, and thanks so much for having me on today.
Yeah.
I think fundamentally I see a lot of founders in Silicon Valley, especially from the 2008 to 2012 time period when they started the company, actually being very wary of going public. And there's almost this generational concern about what are the implications or impact of having a public company versus a private company, where obviously you have a few more degrees of freedom when you're private. And so I do think this is a really interesting one to watch in terms of the signal that it's sending to a lot of founders who still are sitting on very large cap, late stage private companies.
And so where do you feel like – or actually, let me ask it in a different way, Elad. What does this tell us, this sort of movement tell us about the state of funding in Silicon Valley right now and how investors big and small are looking at going public versus staying private in the age of the unicorn?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely an enormous amount of capital out there today, especially relative to traditional levels. So SoftBank is a great example with close to a $100 billion fund. They great invested point. Over $12 billion into Uber alone. And so there is an enormous amount of private capital that's available today that wasn't necessarily available 5 or 10 years ago. And so I definitely do think that Silicon Valley founders have many more options than they used to in terms of different capitalization strategies, be it sovereign wealth, be it late-stage venture capital, or be it a traditional money as well.
Hey, what does that mean for innovation and entrepreneurs and new startups when you do have so much money floating around? Does it mean we get a lot of sloppy companies, or do we get better innovation? I'm just curious, are there any trends that result because there is so much money sloshing around?
I think we kind of end up with both, to be honest. Mm-hmm. I think that probably half of the so-called unicorns are dramatically overvalued and shouldn't be worth $1 billion or more. At the same time, I think there's a lot of very great innovative companies that are doing amazing things. You know, Coinbase's last valuation was a bit over $1 billion. Stripe is another company where I'm very bullish in terms of their long-term prospects relative to their valuation. And so I do think that it's a little bit of a split dynamic right now in terms of amazing companies that will look really cheap in hindsight relative to valuations today. And then honestly, a lot of companies that have really raised far beyond what they should be capable of, in part due to all the money that's available.
To be transparent, though, you've worked with and invested in Stripe, correct?
That's correct. And Coinbase as well.
All right. So I want to turn to your book. And actually, this is a very relevant quote that I pulled out. It comes in chapter 2 called Managing the Board. And you say, if your co-founder is like your spouse, then your board members are like your mother-in-law and father-in-law. You're going to see them regularly. Yeah. They're hard to get rid of, and they can have an enormous impact on your company's future. That is an amazing, amazing metaphor. So tell us about this book. You have some phenomenal interviews in here. How did you decide to do it? And what should people take away from it?
Yeah, so the reason I decided to do it is there's an enormous amount of advice out here in Silicon Valley and blogs or in books like Peter Thiel's 0-1 about the early stages of a startup, but there's actually very little that's been written about the later stages. So instead of going from 0 to 1, how do you take your company from 1 to 1,000? And so the focus of this book is really asking, as you start to scale your company up, how does your role as a CEO change? How should you manage your board? how should you buy other companies for the first time, raise late-stage financing or capital? And so there's a whole set of different issues that late-stage companies have to face, and there's very little content around it. And so I wrote sort of the tactical view of how you approach those things, and then to your point, supplemented it with interviews with folks like Mark Andreessen, Reid Hoffman, the co-founder of LinkedIn, Claire Hughes-Johnson, the CEO at Stripe, and others, to really sort of provide additional viewpoints. I think the big takeaways are, when all is said and done, the complexity of a startup that's growing really fast, that goes from 100 people to 1,000 people over the course of 2-3 years, is extremely high. There's enormous complexity. And the key thing you really have to do is ask about, what are the people that you need to hire and put into place? How do you find people that can fill out your executive team? And then how do you effectively manage them to take the company to the next level?
So only about 20 seconds left. I know it's like asking who your favorite child is, but who was your, yeah, who was your favorite interview or your most surprising interview?
I think one of the interviews that really resonated out here was with Claire Hughes-Johnson, the CEO at Stripe, and she wrote a section about how when she joined Stripe, she actually wrote a document about herself called Working with Claire, and it was all about her quirks as a manager or a leader and how should people best interact or interface with her. Should they send her email or text? What should they discuss with her and when? And I think a number of people now around Silicon Valley, either founders or executives that I know, have started to write their own versions of those guides.
I love it. That's a great piece of advice. Elad Gil, co-founder and chairman of Color Genomics, based in Silicon Valley, joining us on the phone. The book is High Growth Handbook. It's a beautiful book and a must read. Thanks so much for joining us.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's going to drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Just drive, baby.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody, time for the Drive to the Close on this Friday. John Petrides is Managing Director, Portfolio Manager at Point View Wealth Management. John joining us on the phone from Summit, New Jersey. John, good to have you here with Jason and me. Let's talk about Turkey. You saw the news this morning, maybe overnight, looked at the impact it had on some of the financial markets and certainly on Turkey specifically. How do you factor this in terms of longer-term investment moves?
So longer term, there's no factor at all. If there's volatility caused because of Turkey specifically, I would use that as buying opportunities for high-quality companies. But it does give fears of, you know, we're 10 years past the financial crisis, but, Carol, we're lapping 20 years past long-term capital management when you had Fed hedge funds that took on excessive risk and the Russia ruble got devalued, and that sent the global financial markets into a tailspin. So the only fear out of something like this is, you know, is there a hedge fund or some sort of vehicle out there that is too far over its skis that gets caught with this type of reaction, and you have it reverberate through the financial markets? But so far, I don't see any of that happening.
So you don't see European banks or other banks getting caught up in this and their exposure?
I have to see more disclosure from the banks than speculate. Remember, banks are massive institutions. You know, their exposure to Turkey, particularly at this point in time, I would assume is relatively small, if at all, across their loan portfolio.
And how does this factor, John, into your general feelings and your models as it relates to geopolitical risk? I mean, I know Iran is something that's been on your mind, and that's obviously more closely tied to oil prices and their effects on the market.
That to me is the key, right? Is when I was very surprised that the market didn't react more negatively when President Trump and the Prime Minister got into their spat over Twitter a couple of weeks ago, because Iran came out and said, well, maybe, you know, they would threaten to close off the Strait of Hormuz, which is a big channel for where oil goes through globally. So, you know, if that were to happen, that would send oil prices skyrocketing, and that would be clearly bad for global GDP growth. So, you know, that's the big risk with in that dynamic.
So closer to home, we had CPI numbers out this morning. We were talking with our chief economist, Carl Wicadana, earlier, and you know, he was fairly sanguine about this and essentially said that, you know, his view and the Bloomberg Economics view in terms of the Fed raising interest rates through the rest of the year, September is pretty much guaranteed. December, call it 50-50. What do you make of the Fed these days, and what is it, what does the rest of the year hold?
Good question. So I think the first Friday of every month when we have the jobs data, the Fed focuses really on one number, and that's wage growth. And wage growth has really compressed since that January number when it spiked to 2.9%. I mean, it's gone down to 2.8, 2.6, 2.6, and now we leveled off at around 2.7. So that is going to be the trigger that makes the Fed move higher. In terms of September, it is going to be there is some doubt in terms of will the Fed raise rates. There are two things going on. One, it all depends on what the August wage growth is. If that stays muted again, and maybe that questions what the Fed action is. Two, let's not forget the Fed is a political animal, regardless of it trying not to be a political animal. Trump did appoint Powell, and we do have very critical midterm elections coming up in November. So is it possible that the Fed goes on pause in September, but then fulfills its three-hike mandate in December? That's a possibility. The other angle with the Fed is what's their language regarding a potential fourth hike in September, and that's going to have a big impact on the market. So does the Fed say, hey, we're done in September, or do they say, well, maybe we're leaning towards a fourth hike in December?
Right.
Those are all the critical factors.
Yeah, we can debate that, you know, kind of back and forth, and I'm sure we will. Speaking of being on a pause, Elon Musk tweeting on Tuesday, saying maybe it's time to take a pause as a public company and maybe take the company private. I mean, this has been obviously one of our big stories this week, and it continues to turn up on the Bloomberg terminals among the most read stories every day because there is something new every day. The headline we got today, Tesla saying it's looking to seek a wider investor pool for a possible plan to take the company private, kind of spread it around. Where are you on Tesla? Do you guys have a view?
So, A, I love the company but hate the stock from a valuation standpoint. You're very
concerned. Love the company or love Elon?
Or love the car.
I mean, I wish Elon Musk would take the path that Steve Jobs used to do when he was CEO and when he was alive when CEO at Apple, and that's just get off the calls. Stay out of the public eye and be the person that you are, which is an innovator of something that we haven't seen in many years. You know, Musk is considered equivalent to this era's, this generation's Thomas Edison. So there's massive key man risk with Tesla. Not only is the company hemorrhaging cash in a very capital-intensive business, but many people own the stock simply because they can't get enough. They're infatuated with Elon Musk. And if he jeopardized his stake as a CEO of the company because he tweeted out information that was before he going to the SEC, you know, the board may be forced to make him step down as CEO of the company, and that was really bad news for the stock.
Wow. We'll have to see what happens with that. I should point out Tesla shares a little bit higher in today's session, and it is still up 2% for the week despite kind of the back and forth.
Despite all of it.
Right? John Pedrides, thank you. Managing Director, Portfolio Manager at PointView Wealth Management, joining us on the phone from Summit, New Jersey.
Thanks for listening to Coast. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com. You can also listen to the radio show weekdays at 2 p.m. Eastern, only on Bloomberg Radio.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/greenfestival.